When I was in college, I drove a 1986 Ford Tempo. It was a beater of a car, and it had sat for nearly a decade before my dad and my brother fixed it so that I could take it back to school. I remember setting out from Albuquerque early one August morning on my way back to USC in Los Angeles, reasonably sure that the car would reliably get me all the way there. As the miles passed, I began to be more and more confident in the car's ability to traverse the distance until I got to a stretch of road between Kingman, Arizona and Needles, California. With Kingman long in my rearview mirror, I watched as the temperature gauge on the dash inched closer and closer to that H that sits at the top of the gauge. And it wasn't long after I watched that climb that steam began to billow out from underneath the hood of the car. I pulled over to the side of the road. I got out of the car. I took a shop rag with me because I needed it to get the hood open due to the heat of the engine radiating up into the hood. And as soon as I got the hood open, I discovered that the atomic green coolant in the reservoir for my radiator was boiling. I watched as it bubbled, excitedly jumping up and out of the reservoir, spilling up through the cap and onto the ground, realizing that there was no way I could run my engine now. I stood there, looking down at my overheated engine, and then out at the sandy desert around me, the dirt endlessly stretching for miles with no buildings in sight. The late August mid-afternoon sun ruthlessly bathed everything with light, pounding the black pavement and sand as it gathered up the rays and then radiated out the excess heat. The air temperature was already 100 plus degrees and it felt several degrees hotter. If you've been there, you know that the Mojave Desert is just brutal in the summer, making any idea of going anywhere on foot insane. And the partially consumed bottle of Coke that sat in my car just wouldn't last that long. So even though I was stopped on a section of the interstate, the road seemed deserted. Passing cars were few and far between. And suddenly, the thought of getting stuck there began to overwhelm me. Of not being able to get any help, of being stranded without any food and only half a bottle of soda. And as I remember it now, it makes the Israelites' complaints seem totally rational in today's text from Exodus. By the point that we arrive at in the story, the Israelites have spent generations enslaved to Pharaoh in Egypt. Moses went to Pharaoh and told him to let his people go. Pharaoh, of course, wasn't going to let the Israelites go. So God arranged for plague after plague, culminating in the Passover and the Israelites escaping through the parted Red Sea. But soon after, the whole congregation of the Israelites set out from Elam, and Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elam and Sinai. On the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt, the whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger." Standing next to my car in the wilderness between Kingman and Needles, I could imagine why the Israelites were complaining while they stood in the wilderness between Elam and Sinai. The sun beating down and without water or food, they likely knew they would die. Not exactly the kind of freedom they imagined when they left Egypt. The whole congregation complained against Moses and Aaron. "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. Instead, you brought us out here to die." I totally get it. Probably because, in part, if there was ever a week to complain, this feels like it. because emotionally it feels like we have been wandering around in the desert for a few weeks. First, Hurricane Harvey danced around Texas for 4 days, dumping feet of water on Houston, flooding homes, churches, and businesses. Soon after, Hurricane Irma barreled through the Caribbean, ravaging islands before descending upon Florida. Then Hurricane Maria followed and utterly laid waste to Puerto Rico. At last count, 34 people have died on the island, and we have been slow in sending aid. When we woke up on Monday morning, we woke to the news of the worst mass shooting in our history. 59 people dead, another 515 injured, some still clinging to life. The images of this looping on our news for the past week. And then if that weren't enough, Hurricane Nate made landfall last night on the Gulf Coast. On the Gulf Coast again. It feels like, at least to me, that we're standing in the midst of a dry, sun-drenched desert, staring at the endless stretches of sand, wondering from where our help will come. It's difficult to see anything other than sand as I think about how 58 families will now start to call their sister, mother, or brother to talk about plans for Thanksgiving, and then suddenly remember that they can't do that now. Or that a family must not only deal with the loss of their loved one, but also the feelings of dismay and confusion that he would be able to commit such an act of violence. Or how 34 more families of those in Puerto Rico are beginning to realize that they can't ask their father, son, or daughter to come help them rebuild, or even just to come for a visit. I have joined my voice with the Israelites this week. They complained against Moses and Aaron. I complained against the wind and our lack of gun control. Yet this whole time, God, I'm confident God has been listening to my complaint. Just as God listened to the complaints of the Israelites. Then the Lord said to Moses, I'm going to rain bread from heaven for you, and each day the people shall go out and gather enough for that day. In that way I will test them whether they will follow my instruction or not. On the sixth day when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather on other days. The people complained and God responded. The people are starving and God provides bread from heaven. Just enough to meet their needs. No more, no less. Daily. The thing is, though, that the Israelites didn't recognize it at first. And that evening, quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the layer of dew lifted, there was on the surface of the wilderness a fine, flaky substance, as fine as frost on the ground. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And so it is for us as well. God provides us with what we need, always enough, every day. And yet sometimes we still just don't recognize it, even though it's right in front of us. But when we do, when we can recognize what God is up to, it often comes in the form of the people around us. People who gather around those who are struggling with grief, letting them sob as they talk about how different life is. People who reach out months later to say that they're still here. People who donate money to disaster relief and then also spend time loading up trucks with food and water. People who find creative ways to help prevent the violence that we have become so accustomed to. People who cry out against the injustices of the world and work to ensure that all are cared for. People who offer love and grace in the midst of pain and violence. people who are Christ incarnate, for those of us who have trouble seeing God in this world. God has heard our complaints, and God is working to provide for us. We may not be able to see it just yet, but God continues to give us what we need, the bread that we need, just enough every single day.